The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside.
Hello and welcome to The Science Inside. I am Bridget Libere and this episode is the feature science episode, a feature that happens every first Monday of a new month. And this is the period where we give you the face behind a science and we talk to the brilliant minds who are working on fabulous research in their respective fields of science. And as always, we bring to you another dazzling human being. And this week, we speak to Teboho Masebe, who will be joining us all the way from Polokwane, but this will be on the line. Now, Teboho is a geomorphologist. She has just completed her master's in geography at the Rhodes University. And what brings me or all of us here to speak about her is the fact that she was part of an all-female contingent that went on a voyage to the Antarctica for research purposes, obviously, in 2016. And this voyage was said to be the largest contingency of people from the Southern Africa to ever visit this continent. And the Antarctica is almost 7,000 kilometers away from South Africa. And it took the team of 8 scientists a whole 2 weeks to reach this icy destination. Can you imagine that? 2 weeks in a boat. Now what makes Teboho's story so unique is that she was the first black South African female to be part of this field-based team that carried out research on this continent. And the fact that her field of research is very male-dominated, not one to be usually also undertaken for a master's study. And I think this is really going to be an interesting discussion that we are going to have with her. But before we go deeply into this topic, first we look at our news and the interesting events that have been taking place around the world of science and technology. And well, you can also catch us on social media on Facebook as VowFM. You can also tweet us at VowFM hashtag Science Inside. And the podcast is up on iTunes and it's on vets.journalism.co.za/science. Our WhatsApp line, of course, is 084-078-4912. Now we get into our news.
This week's science headline.
In your news making headlines, Rhodes lecturer has received a 3.5 million rand grant to help improve nanotechnology research. And death counts continue to rise from the devastating cyclone Idai. I am Masibulela Luniga with the Science Inside News. Pilani Mashazi, Dr. Pilani Mashazi, rather, a senior lecturer within the Department of Chemistry at Rhodes University, was recently awarded an amount of 3.5 million rands from the National Research Foundation's National Equipment Program. The funds will go towards the upgrade of the time of flight secondary ion mass spectrometer, TOF SIMS in short, which was commissioned in 2014 and launched by then Minister of Science and Technology, Ms. Nalendi Pandor. This equipment is state-of-the-art and first of its kind in South Africa and in Africa, and the equipment can perform analysis with atomic mass resolution as well as molecular ion mass resolution, and the upgrade of the TOF SIMS will increase its capabilities and range of possible analysis. We spoke to Dr. Mashazi to tell us more about what this grant means.
The grant, even though it was for the upgrade of one of our recent state-of-the-art equipment, the equipment itself is a national facility because it is hosted by a chemistry department within the Institute of Nanotechnology Innovation. So there's an institute within the chemistry department. We already do a lot of work for not just Rhodes University, but it's for just all around the country. People that are interested in the application of the toxin as well as one of the other equipment that we use in the NIC, in the institute. So the grant itself is just basically to upgrade it so that we are increasing or adding more facilities or capabilities within the instrument so that it can do quite more than just it could do previously. We'll just be upgrading it. And so with the upgrade, though, there's quite exciting applications that we are envisaging that we'll be able to pursue or do. And that will also lead to much better research in terms of publications and in terms of basically just submitting them for even higher impact journals, international journals. So we are hoping that the upgrade will give us that edge in terms of the research we do.
And the results emanating from the use of this equipment will be published in a high-impact peer-reviewed international journal, thus upholding the reputation of Rhodes University as a research-intensive institution that produces high-quality research. Rhodes hopes to establish a science institute that can compete internationally.
That actually ties in very well with what we've been trying to do with the Institute at Rhodes University, to basically just make a South Africa or scientific research in South Africa be that of international standards, right? So all that we really try to accomplish is instead of basically having state-of-the-art equipment that can be only sourced from Europe or anywhere else in the world, we are trying to create that one, that institute within South Africa that can basically do a lot of applications within the nanotechnology type of research.
And furthermore, postgraduate students at master's and PhD levels will be trained on the use and the interpretation of the results obtained from the state-of-the-art equipment. In our second story, intense tropical cyclone Idai was one of the world's most one of the worst tropical cyclones, rather, on the record to affect Africa and the Southern Hemisphere as a whole in the past weeks. And the long-lived storm caused catastrophic damage in Mozambique, Zimbabwe and Malawi, leaving more than 800 people dead and hundreds more are missing. This has also led to other cases of cholera outbreaks in the countries affected, leading to the first death reported today. The number of cholera cases has almost doubled in Mozambique in the past 24 hours, and the port city of Beira has recorded its first death from the disease since a massive cyclone, struck. And health chiefs warn that there's still to be more catastrophe to be expected. 2.6 million people are now suffering the aftermath of Cyclone Idai. The UN has called it the worst natural disaster to ever strike in the Southern Hemisphere. And the International Red Cross says 90% of the Mozambique's city of Beira was completely destroyed. Claire Fontan of the World Meteorological Organization said during an interview on BBC News that although the disaster itself was in fact anticipated in good time, not much could have been done by locals to actually evade it.
For this case, it was announced far in advance, more than 3 days in advance, that it will be quite a strong tropical cyclone and reaching the Mozambican coastline. The Mozambican authorities have issued a warning, a red alert. The population was warned in advance, but the problem was that it has impacted an area where Beira is 500,000 population in the city, and it's a very flat area, so even if people were asked to leave, the problem was where to, right? Because it's a very flat, you cannot go up the mountains because it's completely flat, so you cannot avoid inundations. People do not have any cars, most of them, basically. And regarding the shelters, there is not so many of them. Even if the forecast and the warning was raised up to the red level and the population knew about that, the problem is what to do because of the last mile. Well, it's always, it's a problem in this case.
And the aftermath may prove to be even more deadlier, with 1.85 million people displaced after an entire village, entire villages were submerged and households rather swept away. And recapping your top stories on the show this hour, Rhodes Chemistry Department receives a grant to improve nanotechnology research, and death counts continue to rise from the devastating cyclone in Idai. I'm Masibule Luniga with the Science Insight News.
This is the Science Insight.
Welcome back to the Science Insight, and we are just recapping our top stories, right? So I want us to talk about the cyclone Idai.
Such a devastating situation. Yeah, really tragic indeed. I think there's just literally more that could have been done, because if you look at how these people were basically, according to, as we heard from Miss Anne Claire, as she mentioned, that actually there were warnings that were actually brought out in time, but still nothing much could have actually been done to actually help prevent the devastating side effects of the cyclone itself. And I think that's the sad reality, to think that we have the facilities, we have the technology, we have the science to anticipate these things, but on the ground we can't do much. And it's not to say nothing could have been done, because had the situation on the ground been better, I think we could have actually had less of a devastating turnout. But it's just really appalling to actually see the results. And now it's obviously leading to other greater things, including cholera outbreaks and other things like that, that are coming as a result of it. And we are actually just waiting to expect more craziness from that side of the world.
I mean, it's really devastating.
Yeah,
and I just wish that, you know, even the government could have been, you know, proactive in helping the people in terms of, you know, protecting them, because science can actually help with things like this, projecting, you know, the outcomes of something that you know each year is going to take place.
Happen.
Yeah. But anyway, moving along from that story, we have, as I had mentioned earlier on, we have a geomorphologist, Teboho Masebe, who has just completed her master's in geography at the Rhodes University, and she is set to graduate in 2 weeks' time, I think she said. She is also said to be the first black woman to carry out research in the Antarctica. I mean, how wonderful is that, really? I mean, it's really amazing that, you know, we see science and things like this taking place, and we have a representation of all kinds of genders and racial or ethnic groups. So it is really fascinating as to what I'm going to be discussing with her today. I'm quite excited. And but before we also go into this discussion with Teboho, I also spoke to her mentor, who is the head of department at Rhodes University and in the Department of Geography and Geology. He's also the principal investigator in the landscape processes in the Antarctic ecosystems. And his name is Professor Ian Meiklejohn. And he spoke to me about a variety of things, about why, because my key question was, why the Antarctica out of, you know, all things? I mean, we are in Africa. And I mean, the Antarctica is so far from Africa. What kind of research are we looking forward to, or the kind of results and discoveries? But before we're going to listen to what Professor Meiklejohn has to say, but I believe we have Teboho on the line. Good evening, Teboho.
Hi, Bridget. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Thank you. Welcome to the Science Inside. And I must really say that I'm really, really intrigued about your research and what kind of things that you're trying to deduce from this research. So your aim was to deduce what kind of effects or impact does atmospheric influences have on the underground, and how it influences how we live or how it influences our lifestyle. So what intrigued me about all of this was, couldn't we have carried it out here in Africa? Why go all the way to Antarctica to give us results about, you know, even things that are affecting us here in Africa?
Okay. Good evening once again, and good evening to our listeners too. So the reason I and my teammates conducted research in Antarctica was because, as most people might realize, Antarctica is no man's land. So by that, I mean, like, it's a continent that has been dedicated to science research. And because of that, countries have no claim to it. So in that way, it is a pristine environment. And because of its pristineness, if I could say that, it serves as an early warning system, as an early climate change warning system, because it has not been influenced by mankind that much.
Yeah, I really hear you. But I mean, what kind of you're saying that it's a pristine environment, but I mean, what kind of changes or how does it vary from our climate? I know that Antarctica is an icy, cold place, and a lot of mammals and other things wouldn't be able to cope or live on that atmosphere. But speaking to your kind of research, I'm just intrigued by the Antarctica and going all the way there, because I understand that the excursion was also a costly one.
Yes, it was. So how does it differ in terms of conducting research here in Africa? Right. Well, like you touched on, Antarctica has a different climate system. But not only that, it also has a different geomorphological system. And by that, I mean, it's a land that is covered by ice, and it doesn't have plant life. It doesn't have trees or things like that. And the only life that is found there is microbial life, and it is, from what I had seen, also bird life. So there aren't mammals as such. There aren't mammals. So questions like, are there polar bears down there? There were none. There were penguins, but only at the coast. And birds coming in and out. But in terms of things that influence the environment is mainly influenced by geological structure of the continent, as well as atmospheric influences. Those are the main things that influence the continent.
All right. So I mentioned your mentor, Professor Michael John. He also commended you on the importance of your research and what this will mean for your future studies and ongoing research on this field. And I have a clip of him talking to the research.
Well, to work there, you've got to be very dedicated. So she's a very dedicated person, was able to handle very tough conditions and also handled a very tough social environment. It's very male-dominated, because most of the people who go down are men. So you have to be able to stand up to that, and she was quite capable of doing that. And you also have to be able to get on with people. And again, she managed that quite comfortably and got on with her colleagues and with the other people around the base. And the base had a construction team there, again, all male. So it's not always easy for women, but she handled it very well. I don't really have a preference as people who want to work with me. And it's interesting that women have been more prepared to work in Antarctica towards a degree than men have. I've had two men in the project since 2012. We've had 11 masters and PhD degrees awarded in it, and of those, only two were for men. The rest were all women. And in the year Tabogo went down, there were three women, and 2 years prior to that, there were five women in my team. So, and they're perfectly capable of doing it, and if they and are interested and motivated, and that's what drives me to select them, is why would they want to work there? And often we get men who want to go down, but they don't want to link it to a degree. In other words, they want to be part of that Antarctic experience without doing the academic work. And it seems that the women who applied all wanted to do the academic side. So, yeah, they all got in. I've never had to turn anybody away.
Now, Tebogo, Prof there was talking about, you know, the selection of people that went on this voyage, right? So, on your side, what kind of findings did you find? Because there were a number of aims and objectives that you had outlined for your study.
The funding that I had was from the NRF. The NRF and NRF, and I also had a scholarship, but the one thing that really covered the trip was NRF, and we were part of the South African National Antarctic Program that helped to facilitate this whole voyage, but funding was mainly from NRF.
Oh, Tebogo, I actually was speaking to the findings pertaining to your research, like when you did go on this voyage, there were a number of things that you had outlined for your thesis, right? So, and one of the things was you wanted to determine the extent of the effects of meteorological events on the ground and how, you know, the temperatures affected. So I wanted to find out, what did you deduce from your findings there?
Okay, the main thing that I could say I discovered, and I'll come into bits of it, was that in this current warming climate that we are in right now, there have been reports that there are ice shelves that are melting in Antarctica, right? But then that's mainly on the eastern side, if I'm correct. However, the part where I was working at within Droning Modland, it showed that as the climate warms up, permafrost and active layer also respond to such changes. So, okay, permafrost is defined as a ground that remains below 0 degrees Celsius for 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that we would expect that as the climate warms up, the active layer, which is the part that is above the permafrost, the part that fluctuates according to varying seasons, would expect that it would increase in depth. That means it would respond to the warming climate by increasing in depth. That means it would thaw over and over and over again, and with that would have a decreasing permafrost. But in my case, I found that as the climate warms up, the active layer gets shallower and shallower. That means it decreases, and the permafrost increases, which then gives is puzzling, because we would expect that if conditions are warming up, we would expect a reverse, but then instead we see the opposite.
And so
that is
all right.
Yeah, that is my main finding.
Mm-hmm. All right, I wanted to speak about this permafrost. Why is there a concern about permafrost?
Okay, permafrost, I would say, also influences how shall I put it? It influences the ice that covers the continent, right? So if ground remains frozen and the frozen part increases, that means that we don't have loss of ice shelves and loss of, well, we don't have increasing water levels, broadly speaking.
Right.
So if I were to speak broadly and bringing it home to Africa and perhaps the rest of the world, we are so concerned with Antarctica because if the climate warms up as it shows that it is, the ice shelves, as have been reported in parts of Antarctica, are melting, and that then increases the world's ocean levels. And with that, we would then be faced with decreasing coastlines and cities along the coastlines being affected.
All right, I see. And so with this research that you have undertaken, where do you plan to implement it or use it for the betterment of society or the continent, which is Africa?
In my case, my research mainly contributed to the growing understanding of the Antarctic landscape. So in terms of bringing it back home, I think that would have to be in conjunction with most research that is being done in Antarctica, not specifically my personal one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so I know that there's a South African research station there at the Antarctica. So it's called Sanay... Sanay 4. I'm not sure what that stands for. I tried to look it up. What kind of, just take us through when you do reach that destination, once you are there, what kind of instrumentation did you have to carry out your research? Did you collect some like ice pieces or rock pieces? What kind of research the kind of process that you undertake to carry out your research?
Okay, so my research, for my research, the methods that I used to collect data were basically to use data loggers. Now, we had data loggers in different sites installed, I can't remember how long ago that was, but they had been installed there for quite a while. And every year, with each new team going down south, they would download the data, for future research. So with my one, I was working with the 2016 data set. And basically when I got to different sites, all I would do was to download the data from the data loggers. And then apart from that, I also collected soil samples. So that's mostly what I did. So I collected soil samples and soil samples along with bulk density measurements. That's mostly what I did.
Okay. And all right, Teboho, please don't go anywhere because we are going to go into another segment of our show. It's called Unscience. And this week's Unscience is brought to you by Masibulele Lunika. And you can find this article on Alive Science. And the music was sourced from No Copyright Sounds on YouTube. Let's get into it.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
So, Bridget, can you just tell me how shaped do you think the Earth is? What shape do you think the Earth is?
I'm caught between the two because first the earth was flat and then it became round. And then we've actually had this interesting conversation with my colleagues before. Yeah. And we're talking about Australia and how, you know, like literally like Australia shouldn't be on the map sort yeah. of a thing, because if the world is or the worldly map is round, then yeah. they don't fit they anywhere don't really fit. Yeah, but it sounds like a tricky question, but I'll still stick with round. Yeah.
I think all the science is basically obviously pointing at that. I mean, obviously, that's what everyone who's very science oriented thinks out there. And it's an interesting and fascinating response that you've given me. But what if I told you that images showing a curved horizon are actually fake, and that photos of a round Earth from space are actually part of a vast conspiracy that is perpetrated by NASA and other space agencies to actually hide Earth's flatness, to try and actually just debunk all the science that suggests that the world is round? I mean, how would you find that piece of information?
Yeah, it is quite interesting. But I mean, it if they say the world is flat, it would still make sense, because to me, it never really made sense why the world was round, because if it's round, you'd think that if you walked for long enough, you'd fall off, because exactly. it has a curve. The world should have a curve. But then you never find that, because if you walk far enough, then you reach a coast somewhere, and then you'd be literally walking into an ocean or the sea or something.
Yeah. Well, basically, there are a group of people that actually think or believe that the world is, in fact, flat. And this group of people is actually now planning to go on a voyage to actually find the tip of the world.
Are you serious? I really would like to go on this voyage with them. I mean, really.
Yeah. Well, let me just tell you a bit more about this. So, organizers of an annual conference that brings together people who believe that the Earth is flat are actually planning to go on a cruise to the purported edge of the planet. They're looking for the ice wall that holds back the oceans, and the journey will take place in 2020. The Flat Earth International Conference, FEIC, recently announced on its website, and the goal is to test so-called flat earthers' assertion, rather, that the Earth is a flattened disk surrounded at its edge by a towering wall of ice.
Do you realize that the name of this conference, it spells out fake?
Are you see? Oh yes, it does. I didn't realize.
Yep.
Okay, well, there you have it. So details about the event, including the dates, are forthcoming, according to Fake, which calls the cruise the biggest, boldest adventure yet. However, it's worth noting that nautical maps and navigational technology, such as global positioning systems, also known as GPS systems, work as they do because the Earth is believed to be actually a globe. So in diagrams shared on the FEX website, the planet appears to be a pancake-like shaped disk with the North Pole smack in the center and an edge surrounded on all sides by an ice wall that holds the oceans back. The ice wall, thought by some flat earthers to be Antarctica, rather, is the destination of the promised cruise.
This is like really ridiculous, but we've got somebody on the line as well who's listening to this, who's been to the Antarctica, and maybe she can, you know, she can tell us if she was at that tip or if it's sort of curved at that point in the Antarctica. But it just sounds really absurd, really.
Yeah. And, what seems to also be the most frightening thing about the cruise is that the question of how they will get there, given that the navigational charts and systems that guide cruise ships and other vessels, rather, around the Earth's oceans are all based on the principle of around Earth. So Hank Cager, a former cruise ship captain, says GPS relies on a network of dozens of satellites orbiting thousands of miles above the Earth, and signals from the satellite beam down to actually to the receiver inside of a GPS device, and at least three satellites are required to pinpoint a precise position because of the Earth's curvature. So whether or not the fake crews will rely on GPS or deploy an entirely new flat Earth-based navigation system for finding the end of the world remains to be seen.
Very interesting. I remember there was something on TV that used to be called A Journey to the Center of the Earth?
I think the guys went literally inside
the core of the Earth
and discovered an entire world where dinosaurs still exist. And it was quite an interesting imagination.
really interesting.
Interesting.
Well, that was Unusual, Unlikely, Unscience.
Unusual, Unlikely, Unscience. Stay curious, stay informed, stay on the Science Inside.
Welcome back. We are still on the Science Inside. We are still chatting to geomorphologist Tebogo Masebe from the Rhodes University, who visited the Antarctica to find out if the pristine environment in that continent may hold the answers as to how rapidly changing the climate is affected by meteorological events and how these events are fast changing our environment. So we are back with Tebogo. Tebogo, welcome back.
Thank you, Bridget.
Hi. Yes, now we get to the interesting part, which is the interview where we get up close and personal with you. We find out more about your journey with geography and a bit more on Antarctica. Now, I would like to know about your journey as a little girl. How was it growing up in the village of Makhose in Polokwane? Because I know you said earlier on that you were a bit of a bookworm, a nerd, young person who was interested in mostly her studies. But tell us, what was it like growing up there?
I think I would say I had a normal childhood like most kids. Not all kids are bookworms and not all kids love school, but I was unusual in that I was the typical nerd at school. I didn't wear glasses like what you see on TV, but that was me at school. I'm not sure where my love for school or for science came from, but growing up, I was just curious about the world around me. As a child, my aspirations changed a lot, but they were mostly around science-related careers, science-related subjects. And I was lucky enough in that I also had parents who encouraged my love for the sciences and the sciences and everything that encompassed it.
All right. Yeah. So how do you then come to geography? Were there influences who sort of showed you the path to geography and said, you know, this path will lead you to the Antarctica or something like that?
That is a very long story, but to cut it short, so in high school, like I said, I was a science fanatic, and I actually wanted to do physics when I went to varsity. I wanted to study physics, and in my first year, that's what I enrolled for. But then throughout the year, I found physics to be challenging. I don't know if I just could not cope with first year pressures or that the workload was just too much, but I found it quite challenging. And on top of that, I slowly just lost interest in it. And we had a field trip at some point in time where we evaluating or going to checking out physics in the everyday life, like what careers you could do with it. And I don't think I was that satisfied with what I saw or what I found. So then come second year, I switched courses, and I just thought, I enjoyed geography in high school, so why not? Let's just do it and see how things will turn out. And I actually fell more in love with it the second time around. But still, the idea of going to Antarctica was so far-fetched in my mind. I don't know what I actually wanted to do with geography. I think at that stage when I enrolled for it, it was just for the love of it. And I just wanted to see how far it will take me.
Mm-hmm.
So then in third year, that's when I decided to do geography honors. It was actually a tough year because I had to choose between doing chemistry and doing geography. And I loved both subjects. I was very passionate about them both. So I decided, let me just go for geography. And then at the end of the year, my supervisor was like, there's an opportunity for people who want to go to Antarctica to do a master's research there. And then I thought, well, I don't really have much to lose, and I'm not really sure what I want to do next year in terms of jobs. I wasn't ready yet to go out to the job world. So I thought, okay, let me do a master's, and what better field to do a master's in than, you know, going to Antarctica? There's not a lot of people that get to have that opportunity to go down there. So I was quite privileged in that I wasn't turned down in my request to do a master's in it. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. Quite an interesting story. But, I mean, this journey to the Antarctica, I want you to take us through it. I mean, you are in a boat for 2 weeks heading to this icy, barren place, and you spent about like over 6 weeks in this icy climate. What was your experience like? I mean, not all of us will get an opportunity to go to the Antarctica, and I don't think many of us will withstand the temperatures there.
I think for me the whole journey as a whole was very exciting, plus meeting new people on the ship too. It was quite exciting. I had been on the ship before, but not for such a long period. So that's the first time where I had seasickness. And I remember the first time I saw an iceberg with in actual reality, not on a computer screen or in TV or wherever. It was quite exciting. And there are some things where you see them live and you just cannot fathom the greatness of what you're seeing. Okay, so then we get to Antarctica eventually, and I just could not believe at how huge the ice shelf was. I was listening to your conversation earlier about flat earth and a globe. Well, I'm not a flat earther, and I won't speak down on flat earthers, but I believe that the earth is a globe. And yes, there is a wall, but it's not a wall that encloses the flat earth. The wall that I saw was an ice wall, an ice shelf, and it was meters and meters high. But anyway, so we get to the continent and we get on land or / ice, and we flew to the base. And I remember one of the most exciting things that happened when I was there, I experienced snowfall for the first time. It was quite lovely. And I remember I'm extreme weather junkie. So there was a time when we had a snowstorm, and I was just so excited. I was so excited. You could not see anything far beyond your stretched arm. And for some reason, I had never experienced such a thing here at home. So I was just, I know it was quite dangerous, because were you to go outside by yourself, you could have gotten lost, or you could have been injured or got, you know?
Precisely.
But I was just so excited and intrigued, because I'd never seen such a thing before. And I knew that that was special because it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And also the quietness and the silence of being in the field. It's so quiet. You know when they say the silence is deafening? I got to experience that. It was just so quiet. You could hear your thoughts. You could, it was just amazing. And overall, the continent is just so beautiful. I could not stop marveling at being there over and over and over again. Yeah. I just got to appreciate being there and thank God so much. It's just like, this is beautiful.
It turns out like you are an adrenaline junkie as well. I mean, you're excited by weather, that dangerous weather change in the Antarctica. But I also know there were a number of things that you had to do to in order to prepare yourself for this excursion so that you could cope with, you know, the different climatic change and also adjusting to, you know, the weather and the, what do you call it, the sea levels and things like that?
I did quite a few of things, actually. Well, we know that there aren't people there, and by default, there aren't places where you could go shop for things. So first thing I did, amongst other things, is just to stock up on things that are going to use down there. I didn't want to be in short of any supplies. And then I also exercise just to keep my body healthy, and spoke to people who had been there before. We had students who were in their second year of master's. We were still in our first year of master's, so we would speak to them about their experiences down there. And also our supervisor kept on encouraging us and just, preparing us for being down there mentally. But overall, I think the excitement of just being there took care of most of the fears that we might have had of being down south.
All right. And I understand that you also went there during the summertime. So I also believe that the sun never sets there. I mean, it's a very deceptive environment where it's just day in, day out. And you could find yourself losing sight of time and just being, you know, lulled away by, you know, this illusion of it being day all day. What was the experience like with, you know, this encounter? Because, I mean,
So on days where we were not out in the field, it was just like a normal, ordinary day. So, yes, the sun does not set, but inside the base, we had curtains that were pitch black. So during night time, we would close the curtains or the blinds and it would just be pitch black. So it didn't really affect us that much. The time when it did affect us was when we were out in the field, because we'd find that we left the base in the morning and we were out and it would be around 4 o'clock in the late afternoon and it would still appear like it was still noon. Mm-hmm. So eventually we relied on our clocks to basically just tell us that it's getting late, or on us being physically tired to inform us that it's time to head home or we should be about to finish now because it's getting late. But in terms of knowing, just looking at the sky, yeah, it was quite deceiving. But it was also quite beautiful because we got the opportunity to, you know, just walk out at 10 in the evening or 12 in the evening and it will still be bright outside. So, yeah, that's something that you don't get to see every time.
And briefly, do you have any words for young people who would like to, you know, go through this this field of study or do studies in geography? Do you have any words of encouragement or any field of science? Do you have any words of encouragement for young people out here?
I would say, whatever it is that you're passionate in, be it in high school or varsity, whatever it is that you're passionate in, just work hard at it and don't be scared of failures and don't be scared of asking questions, because a lot of us get intimidated by asking questions. I know for me, from experience in first year, that's what really made me suffer, if I could say that. But yeah, don't be scared to ask questions and to be curious and inquisitive. And as they say, the sky is the limit. So if it can be done, you can do it.
Wow, nice and sweet. But before you go away, we also have just a short clip of the professor sharing his words of encouragement to you.
That she takes her experience through and uses it as an educational experience, which will help her in any job that she does. Dealing with the issues she had to deal with in Antarctica will make her a much stronger person and enable her to be able to handle work situations in a much better and much easier way.
And there was Professor Ian Makeljohn. And Tebogo, with that being said, I would like to say thank you for being on our show. It was a really enlightening interview. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you, Bridget, and thank you to your listeners. Thank you for this opportunity of being on your show.
Only a pleasure. Bye. Now you've been listening to our interview with a geomorphologist, Tebogo Masebe, from the Rhodes University. And we are just going to take a short break and we'll be back.
This is the Science Inside.
Hello and welcome back. You have been listening to The Science Inside, and we are actually on at the end of our show. We were speaking to our feature scientist for this week, Tebogo Masebe from the Rhodes University, and she specializes in geomorphology, where she looks at how the environment is influenced by atmospheric influences such as solar radiation, wind speed, and things like that. And she went to the Antarctica, and she was the first black female from South Africa to visit the Antarctica to carry out her research. But with that being said, we would like to thank all of our guests who were featured on the show tonight. Tebogo Masebe, Professor Ian Makeljohn, Dr. Philani Mashazi, and Claire Fontan. And today the team behind the scenes is production by Masibulele Lunika and tech by Kutwano Serame. Our podcast is on the WITS website, wits.journalism.co.za/science, and on iTunes as well. And our social media handle on Facebook is VowFM, and on Twitter is @VowFM. The Science Inside is produced by the WITS Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. With that being said, good night from us.
The Science Inside Podcast.